Hello and welcome back to another edition of Editing Aloud. And what a week it's been. Zimbabwe has got a new leader, or is about to get a new leader. The race for the leadership of the ANC in this country is hotting up, as Ray Hartley will tell us all about it in a minute. But panel, who expected the Zimbabwe thing to begin and end, Rondobi, as quickly as it did?
No one did. No. I mean, especially after Sunday, when he came out, it was quite an awesome speech, the way he put it to us. And it basically said, no one at all expected at all this to happen at all. So it was quite a surprise to me yesterday how it fell out. Yeah.
But would it have been a surprise to Zimbabweans, I wonder? I mean, the huge demonstrations and on the Saturday, and obviously after he resigned formally on Tuesday, we know that that's pent up stuff, but was it organized, or was it simply, you know, just the people running out of their houses and expressing joy? What do you think? Have anybody seen anything like this?
I mean, one of the peculiar things that occurred was that these demonstrations were permitted by the security forces, which in itself is strange, you know. So it tells you the kind of grip that these security forces actually have and probably continue to have on that society. But I think it was a foregone conclusion by then that he would have to go, because the process had been mapped out to him. You quit or you will be impeached. And he called a cabinet meeting.
What were they going to impeach him for? What had he done?
I thought it was more complicated than that. But in fact, as I understood the sort of legislative positions, he could be impeached for not governing properly, and they were going
so
to.
So it could be that vague.
From what I can make out, they were going to basically say he's old and nuts and not capable of governing properly.
But it's Sanu who impeached him, right?
Yes.
So essentially, they're recalling their president and saying we're going to install.
They recalled him already.
He wouldn't go with that extraordinary speech in front of the cameras, where he switched the papers. And it does, I suppose, I watch all this stuff and it's very exciting, but I also fear for Zimbabweans, because it is so exciting, and yet the people who've sort of liberated them, if you like, masterminded by Mr. Mnangagwa and the army, are not presumably to be trusted, because these are people with a pretty authoritarian past. So it did need the military to open the lid, to lift the lid, if you like. But we have to see going forwards whether democracy is what we get.
I mean, does Emmerson Mnangagwa now appreciate, having seen this sort of outpouring of joy, what he has on his hands and how big his opportunity is? Or does he just revert to type and become just a younger version of Robert Mugabe? What does he do?
I think it all hinges on whether he can get an economic solution of some kind on the table.
And that economic solution has to be a bailout of sorts. They have to get some kind of international bailout, whether from the Chinese or the BRICS Development Bank or the IMF. They need $1 billion
IMF, like
now.
7 billion or something. So I'm sure the IMF will come in there and say all your SOEs and so on need to be sold over. So there will be something of that. But I was thinking, Mugabe is, I think, the end of Mugabe, actually the end of ZANU-PF. I think people are, ZANU-PF, those that remain, are kind of fooling themselves to thinking, no, we'll carry on without Mugabe there. But I think he is ZANU-PF. So I think even the Emmerson who comes in now, he must get a point. But I don't think ZANU-PF will survive beyond the next election. And so politically, I agree with Hillary. I'm pretty worried about what will happen to Zimbabwe without him at the helm.
I think what could counter it is that the economic opportunity is enormous, and probably everyone will be telling them that, because one forgets that in the early days of Mugabe's rule, the economy like really took off, and exports took off, and Zim really was doing well, and now it's even better positioned. First of all, South Africa next door is not a hugely attractive destination. It's just got to get a few things right. They're big things to get right, and you will get foreign investment, and you will, it's quite, I mean, the IMF.
But with 90%, so you could get unemployment down from 97% to, say, 57%, but you still got the biggest unemployment problem in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, you have an agricultural sector that's completely melted down. The manufacturing industry is 25% smaller than it was in 2000.
The public debt is extraordinary.
The other thing is that the world has moved on.
Yeah.
I mean, Zimbabwe used to be the jewel of Africa, or breadbasket of Africa, whatever it might be. But even if you've got all the farmers working again, Africa's moved on. The world has moved on. It's a different kind of place, you know.
I was just saying to someone where in 2000 there was no Facebook, there was no, none of this iPhone, the whole world, had, like the fourth industrial revolution hasn't taken place. Now, farming is automated. So even if farming, like tomorrow, Zimbabwe is flowing.
And the fourth industrial revolution is almost over.
It's over, too. So
it's over the first, and then the third, and the fourth.
In terms of automation, farmers won't employ as many people as they probably did in the 90s, the 80s, and so on. So that quick fix, so even.
I think that's not the only factor, though, in agriculture, because it is an incredible place to farm. Just from the point of view of productivity per hectare before you even start introducing technology. So they've got, and I think the huge advantages that they have, a young population, highly educated population, and an incredibly hardworking ethos in that population is a.
Our risk as South Africa is that they all go back again.
What do we do?
Who is going to? Really, we're very heavily dependent, I think, on Zimbabwean skills.
Perhaps that'll help our unemployment rate, you know, so reduce.
But also, I mean, you have this whole generation of people that have gone out into the world and earned themselves a whole bunch of skills that might, some of them, return.
Yeah.
But we spoke to quite a few investors about whether they would go back to Zim now with Mugabe gone, and I think most of them said no, they're not going to until there's a real sign of a proper political system in place.
So what you need is that you need to see a proper election take place, people behaving properly, no repression of people, particularly in rural areas, because I think the cities or the towns in Zimbabwe have proven themselves to be sort of, you know, hotbeds of happiness in a way. About Mugabe game, but I mean, you don't get any insight into what's happening in the, you know, in rural areas. A lot of people try to draw parallels between South Africa and Zimbabwe, and the more I watched the TV and watched things being explained, the more I thought that we are not like them or they are not like us at all. I mean, the military is a wing of the party, which is how they were able to swing it so quickly. So it wasn't really a coup in the traditional sense of the word. It was an intra-party rebellion.
I mean,
are there parallels? I mean, are there any lessons for South Africa in this right?
Well, I mean, I think there are parallels. I mean, you have an aging despot trying to insert his wife as a successor. The deputy president is being sidelined, who's the party's preferred.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are those parallels.
And also, I guess, from ANC point of view, 2000, that swing to ultra populism to stay in power, and that's the type of the ANC we always think with Zuma, if it continues, that they're going to shift more to the populist policies. And this is almost like 17 years later, this is what.
But I mean, there was nothing populist about what Mugabe was doing. It was unpopulist, it was certainly unpopular. Given the amount of people we saw on the streets. I mean, were there populist policies?
I mean, like in 2000, when he went that route of land grabs, that was a ploy to get back into power, right? Yeah. At the end of the day, he lost all popularity. But that's the whole thing. The ANC should look at that, like if they move to that direction. But you have to answer to it, right? So you move on the populist ticket of taking all the land back, but you still have to feed your people and economically look after your economy. So this is maybe an example for the ANC to look
at. So they have to hold an election in Zimbabwe. They're scheduled to hold an election next September, right? ZANU-PF surely will win that, Hillary, no? I mean, there's not an obvious opposition out there to take it away.
I think that's another parallel with South Africa, the weakness of the opposition.
The other thing that I thought about Zimbabweans, they came to power when they were young, those guys. I mean, Mugabe was 50, in his 50s when he became president. Our guys were much older. You know, the ANC, because it took that much longer to win their liberation war, they were much older when they took over. And I don't know whether that puts, I think it changes, you know, although we have aging despots trying to put their wives or ex-wives into power. One lot seems to be, I mean, the old guard in ZANU-PF is still in the party. Ours isn't, the ANC's old guard is out of the party, having meetings that nobody goes to. As stalwarts, you know, making grim sounding noises.
One of the parallels which is a bit disturbing is if you look historically, the the economy starts to go south in the, I think it was the 1990s, at which point you start blaming Western powers for this problem. And we've heard hints of it here, actually.
Yeah,
we've heard Zuma saying that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And the economy stops delivering, and then that's when you turn to the popular solution. So I think it is probably a reminder for us that this is a tipping point for us, and that if you go the wrong way, it takes a very long time and a huge amount of damage, an incalculable amount of damage to get back.
But I do think one of the real differences between us and Zimbabwe is that next year in August, when they have the election, if Mnangagwa doesn't win, there's a sense that the army might insert him anyway or insist he is the leader. Whereas I don't think that's the situation we're in this country. I think we're far from that. So I think fundamentally in terms of the strength of our democracy, and even though our institutions have been weakened considerably, I still think it's a lot stronger than Zim. So I still think we're in a much, much better position. So I don't think I think the parallel breaks down in that respect. Fundamentally at the bottom
level
of democracy.
Do we know what Mugabe's going to do? Is he going to carry on living in Zimbabwe, or is he going to come south or north?
Today's Business Times, Business Day story says he's already left the country, and there's talk of Singapore and so on. So that's...
He needs to be in close proximity to the doctors that keep him alive.
Yes, no, absolutely. Right, let's just talk quickly about the ANC leadership race. You've got new numbers that you've done. Showing that it's very close, that Cyril is marginally in the lead. That's after counting what proportion of how many branches have now voted?
Yeah, I think based on the new branch numbers and then the percentages, some of the percentages are clear. For example, in Mpopo, we know that 87% have come out in favor. So you can do the maths. And it's incredibly close. I mean, it's a...
What do you have at the moment?
I have Ramaphosa at about 2,597. And
is that delegates or branches?
Voting delegates.
Okay.
And Dlamini Zuma at 2,576.
So it's 20.
And that's there's a lot of guesswork in that.
There are a lot of people, aren't there, panel, arguing already that Cyril has got this thing and it's all wrapped up and it's in the bag, but it's just not, is it?
No, far from it, right? It was, heading to 2007, I was speaking earlier on, we all thought Mbeki was going to win it until there was a last gust of swirl that told you it's lost, right? And Ramaphosa doesn't... I mean, that last push to say, okay, Ramaphosa's winning this thing, I haven't quite got that feeling that he's got it all wrapped up. Although we're all hoping tentatively that he will win it. But there's still this whole thing that Zuma or his candidate is likely to win for now. Hopefully it swings in the last weeks or so.
There's two provinces, I think, that will make the fundamental difference. KwaZulu-Natal, which goes to court, I think it's next week, to decide on that election of the provincial executive that ultimately could determine who gets those votes. And that's crucial. It's the ANC's largest province, as well as Mpumalanga, where David Mabuza, the chairperson of Mpumalanga, might be, of course, Zana Dlamini Zuma's deputy. And that'll swing Mpumalanga probably either way.
And I still think the biggest risk is whether the conference happens at all, especially if Cyril is in the lead.
Yeah. We'll be back just after this break. Welcome back. While Zimbabwe has been re-liberated or recaptured, there's been some fascinating hearings going on in Parliament into state capture at ESCOM. And yesterday, late last night, Brian Molefe gave evidence to the committee. He was very self-confident. The people questioning him, the parliamentarians questioning him, were very aggressive. It was riveting television. And Sikonathi, how do you think he came out of it? I mean, I think he got himself into more trouble than he got himself out of. But there are details about this story that I'm lost on.
He was between a rock and a harder place.
Yeah.
Because if he told the truth, he was in even bigger trouble. If he lied, even in bigger trouble. And he tried very hard to do both at the same time, and he was not going to come out smelling of roses after that.
Yeah.
Not at all.
But what was so interesting was that he seemed to be able to, he wanted to draw a clear difference between himself and the board. In other words, he wasn't at the board meeting, he claims, when the late night board meeting when Tegeta was paid 586 million or 600 million or whatever it was. And so it was just nothing to do with him. And there are a whole lot of instances where, but as the CEO, you're on the board, surely, and you know what happens at board meetings and you know what positions they
take. And it happens because you said it must happen. It happens because you need that code. It happens because you need that money. And now for him, it happens, he may not physically be at the board, but Tuli Madonsela showed us 58 calls, which he did not deny. And he said, at the time we were not at the board meeting, you were at the Ship Inn at Saxon World House, you were on the phone with those guys, you were discussing exactly what
he
the board
very, had to But be. He very snarkily, I thought, quite arrogantly said, these calls, these calls, as they are reported in Tuli Madonsela's report, mean nothing. There's no times and there's no dates. My information is that that's required for a fact to exist.
That's nonsense. He's not denying the existence of the calls.
Yeah.
He's never denied it. I asked him on 16 November 2016. I asked him 2 days later, and he's always said, I will talk about those calls when the time is right. The time is now right. He again.
And he's not talking about
that. He's not talking about it.
No.
What he cannot deny is that he did make those calls. In fact, he questioned, how did Tuli Madonsela get my phone records?
Yeah.
Now, that's far from saying I did not make those calls. That's also far from saying I did not go to the Ship Inn, to the compound, the Gupta compound.
He in fact said
I was two streets away from them. There's a Ship Inn there, and he couldn't give me the address of the Ship Inn. And he couldn't find any other place an alibi to say I was not at the compound, but I was at. I asked for the address. He didn't give it to me. What were you discussing on those phones? He said, when I've got the opportunity in a legal framework, I will respond.
Well, he had a lawyer sitting next to him, and they did all that sort of American thing where you put your hand over the mic and then have a quiet conversation with your legal advisor as you're testifying. It was riveting stuff. I've never seen that in the South African Parliament. At one stage, he was asked about the money that was paid after this late night meeting. There's a big question about whether it went to Tegeta or whether it went to pay for Optimum. And basically his answer was, I don't care where it went. We were, as far as I was concerned, we're paying for coal. If I buy a car from Volkswagen, I don't ask them what they do with the money afterwards. Which is an incredibly arrogant way of answering.
Someone executed a big fraud on the people of South Africa there. I've got a board resolution that says let's help Optimum with a prepayment. At the same time, I've got a guarantee that goes to APSA that says the board of Eskom has agreed to give this guarantee to Tegeta.
Even though it was never given, but they'd agreed to give it.
Absolutely
yeah.
not.
Was he at those board meetings?
He was not at that particular board meeting.
Yeah.
This is the one he says he was not.
Yeah.
But on the same day, there are the phone calls with him and the brothers.
Yeah.
And at the same day, PM Aston had met Anuj Singh. And at the same day, Anuj Singh had been sitting with Salim Essa. Now, who signs the guarantee to the bank? It's the chairman of Eskom. It's the chief executive of Eskom. It's the chief financial officer of Eskom.
Well, the chief financial officer of Eskom at the time, Anuj Singh, he's got a heavy burden to come because of every second question that Brian Molefe was asked, he said, well, ask the chief financial officer when he comes to testify.
Almost more extraordinary has been the former chairman Zola Tsotsi's evidence.
Well, he's testifying today,
he's
right?
I think the really important thing is that this is one of the first times, if not the first time, that we've had a real link from state capture straight back to President Zuma. Because if you think about all
what
of Gupta leaks, the link is that he, Zola Tsotsi, has testified that he was called in to Zuma's house where he met Tudu Mayeni, the chairperson of SAA, not the chairperson, or not anyone with any authority at Eskom, as far as we know, who and Ms. Mayeni and Zuma together instructed him to suspend the executives who were subsequently suspended.
This is Chidiso Matona.
This is Zola Tsotsi, the former chairman.
To me, it's incredibly significant. In so many of the Gupta leaks, in fact, in all the Gupta leaks, we haven't had Zuma's name appearing anywhere. This is the first time or one of the first times that we have seen the president himself actually appear in the saga in on the record.
Would Duruma Yeni have just been there by chance? I mean, what would she? What role would she have in telling Zola Tsotsi what to do?
No, in terms of the SOEs, she's almost like the linchman, regardless where it's SA, ESCOM. Mm. So this is perfectly how he operates, right? Yeah. It's always the way the stories I've heard about how the president works. He gets someone else to give you the instruction,
sure.
And he comes off to his knocks. Okay, so are we okay? That's what he does, yeah. Right? This is exactly how to work. Yeah, this is how when it comes to energy as well. His energy advisor. I remember there was a meeting that the energy advisor had with Pravin Gordhan about nuclear. It was the same conversation where the energy advisor told Pravin to deal with the Russians.
This is Zuma.
And then only after Zuma comes in and says, "Hey, have you guys chatted? Okay, that's exactly so." This story about Duruma is typically how the president works, actually. This is how the modus operandi of our number one has
that's been. Exactly what he did on that day. So that's what he told me in two meetings in Feb.
Yeah.
I met him twice.
This February,
2017, when I was writing the Denton story.
Yeah.
He at that point was very nervous and he kept looking over his shoulder. We're sitting at a hotel somewhere in Johannesburg, and he refused to be quoted. He said, "You can't quote me, but this is exactly what happened." And Jacob Zuma, 15 minutes later, strolled into the room and said, "Mfanagit, did you get the instruction? Now you understand exactly what to do. Thank you. Off you may go." Off he went to Johannesburg. He then said, "Jacob Zuma is so sneaky. He's so clever. He does not talk on the phone.
Never.
He will just." Summon you, and when you get there, he exactly what Ron has just described.
This is how he works.
That's how he works. Zola Tsotsi, I'm glad he's now found his voice. He said exactly those things twice to me in Feb when I met him, but on both occasions he refused to be quoted on the record, and that's why I never wrote it, because there was nobody else to help me with that information.
And so what does this revelation mean politically for Zuma? It's the first time he emerges. Mm. As a central player in state capture, the removal of that executive team. There were four people. Yeah. Only one came back. That was Koko. If we now know that Zuma is that implicated in it, what is the political consequence of that?
I think the consequence is after December. Like if he doesn't win the ANC thing, but there's only. There might be a price to play for him, but if December goes well, I don't think there's any consequence, right? There's a sad thing about this country right now. But it's almost established that he's a key player in state capture. Everyone kind of gets that idea. Even
right,
as we approach
the December conference, do the little things still matter? I mean, does it matter, you know, that Zuma has seemed to have been sort of caught napping on Zimbabwe? Does it matter that his name now comes up directly from a former chief executive of a former chairman of ESCOM, who he had a hand in employing in the first place, now says that he was given instructions by Zuma to fire people. Does that count still? I mean, is it?
I think that.
I mean, do the books matter? Does you know that are coming out, Jacques Poe's thing, whatever it might be? Are they little things? And your very good book, by the way. Somebody hold it up. Right? You didn't bring me a copy. Ron's got a copy. Here we go.
There we are.
Ray Hartley's new book.
I think they do matter, but less and less, because the branch finalization of the branch decisions about their candidates is taking place now.
Yeah.
They've just been extended for a brief period, but that'll be over. So the branches will mandate people who to vote for, and that's done. And anything could happen between then. The only thing that would change the voting would be any inducements that branch members might get at the conference itself, which is strongly rumored to be what takes place.
So somebody comes up along with a bag of cash and says, "Look, you know, I know your branch voted for Cyril, but he has 10,000 rand."
That's what happened in 2007.
What does it cost to get somebody to change their vote? And how do you know they've changed their vote anyway? Why don't you just take the money and vote the way you wanted to?
I was discussing this with a colleague upstairs who has a lot more insight into this than I do, and she said that you know, there's a down payment. You don't get the full amount. You get a down payment, a taste, and then if it turns out that your candidate wins, you get the rest.
Okay. Mm.
So you actually have to go along with it.
Yeah. And Hillary, the other thing that may matter, that may count, depending, you know, for December, is happens this Friday when both Standard & Poor's, S&P and Moody's re-rate us. And after the medium-term budget policy statement in October, which is pretty dire, what chances do we have of escaping a downgrade?
Zero.
Zero.
The only question, there are only two real questions. The first is that S&P is considered definitely going to go. They've already downgraded our foreign currency rating to junk. They'll go with the local currency too. And that is pretty evident just in what they've said, had said before the budget even. And it's not just the budget, it's also the president's effort to intervene with the free fees and Michael Sachs's departure and all of that. Put all together undermines the one strength that we had, one of the strengths we had. The question is, one question is, does Moody's go now or do they go in a month or two? Because Moody's has a tendency to move very slowly and they have this putting people on watch, which they've done to us before, which would then give them a month or two to make up their minds. But I think it is pretty much inevitable that our local currency ratings by both agencies will be junked sooner rather than later.
And just what are the implications?
The other question is the implications.
Then there's a certain amount of money that they simply can no longer be invested here, right?
Indeed, yeah.
And how much is that?
That is estimated at being anything from 80 billion to 130 or 140 billion rand.
Okay.
Now that is the South Africa is in the WGBI index, the global WGBI index.
Yeah.
It's local currency bonds. It's rand denominated bonds, and there are a large number of foreign investors who track that index, the WGBI. If South Africa is booted out, they leave. The question is, to what extent
is there a large sort of sucking sound as the money leaves, or does it leave slowly? I mean, if you bought bonds,
it leaves quickly, but there are other people who could buy them.
Okay.
Other foreign investors, more risky, more risk.
Doesn't it take like 3 months to be kicked out? Yeah. Isn't it? It's a 3 month process, so it isn't.
So the harder, longer they fall, the more attractive the yield is. So you might as well buy them.
And look, that's what we don't know. That's the real question: is how much has the market already priced in? How much of the capital has already flowed out? So that we'll have to see.
All right. Well, it never stops. So beware Friday. And we'll see you next week. And we'll by that stage, we'll know.